From Montpelier, Vermont, this is Public Health Radio. On today's show, we'll be looking at two environmental health problems. First, Michael Bender will be joining us to discuss the impacts of human exposure to mercury and a recent policy change under consideration at the Environmental Protection Agency. Then, later in the show, Karen Perry will discuss the persistent organic pollutants and the Bush administration's approach to implementing a global agreement designed to reduce exposure to these toxic chemicals. But first, some news from the world of public health. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. The British Medical Journal reports that the medical aid agency, Doctors Without Borders, has suspended activities in Afghanistan after five of its staff were killed on June 2nd in one of the worst attacks on humanitarian workers since the fall of the Taliban regime in 2001. Their vehicle was apparently hit by gunfire and grenades in the northwestern province of Badghis. They were part of a team active in the province since 1999 and had created a new clinic in Khyber Khana that in the first 4 months of this year had already treated 6,000 patients. Tuberculosis treatment for 45 patients had recently begun, and 2 weeks ago, the team opened a maternal and child health clinic. Doctors Without Borders said publicly that its thoughts were with the families of those murdered, but also with the population of Afghanistan, whose access to health care and other humanitarian help is being increasingly put in jeopardy. It is now analyzing the situation, but in the short term has suspended its activities with the exception of emergency care, which will continue with Afghan staff. All of its international staff are returning to their headquarters, while local support staff in Khyber Khana are being brought to a safe location. According to the Associated Press, a spokesman for the Taliban admitted its responsibility for the attack, saying there would be more attacks in the future because it viewed foreign aid workers as providing tacit support for the policies of the United States. In February, the former International Secretary of Doctors Without Borders, Dr. Morten Rostrup, worried that the organization would be viewed as co-opted into the war on terror. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan condemned the cold-blooded killing of unarmed aid workers and said that the deaths had confirmed fears of a worsening security situation in the country. The Food and Drug Administration, known as the FDA, on May 6 overruled the recommendation of its own expert advisory panel and declined to approve over-the-counter status for the contraceptive known as Plan B. Plan B is taken within 3 days after unprotected sex and is 88% effective in preventing pregnancy. The FDA ruled that before the drug could be sold without a prescription, the company would have to provide additional data showing that Plan B can be used safely by women younger than 16. Only a small number of patients included in Plan B's submitted research were under that age. Critics pointed out that the medication used in Plan B, a progesterone, is identical to oral contraceptives that have been on the market for 40 years and have been used by millions of girls under the age of 16. Stephen Galson, acting director of the FDA's Center for Drug Evaluation and Research, acknowledged that the decision was far from typical. Normally, when the FDA evaluates a drug for over-the-counter use, it looks at whether it is toxic or addictive, assesses its side effects, and considers how it's absorbed, distributed, metabolized, and cleared by the body. The FDA's decision against Plan B, however, was based on concerns that go well beyond medical safety, taking into account the impact its availability might have on teen sexual behavior. Galson said he worries that if young women had easier access to emergency contraceptive, some of them might be more likely to have sex without condoms, exposing themselves to an increased risk of sexually transmitted infections. Outrage over the FDA's decision boiled in Congress as over 40 members of the House sent a letter on May 7th to acting FDA Commissioner Lester Crawford, charging the agency with putting politics before science. At a news conference, Representative Louise Slaughter, a Democrat from New York, and Chris Shays, the Republican from Connecticut, called on the director of the FDA to resign and asked the General Accounting Office to investigate the process by which the FDA had made its decision, since it's so unusual for an FDA director to ignore the recommendation of its own scientific advisory panel. The American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists issued a strongly worded statement calling the FDA's action morally repugnant and a dark stain on the reputation of the FDA as an evidence-based agency. For now, it's unlikely that emergency contraception will achieve over-the-counter status until there is a new FDA director, since their request for studies on girls 15 years old and under would take a long time to implement, primarily because very few teens aged 15 and younger seek emergency contraception. The FDA's decision, at least temporarily, returns leadership on expanding access to emergency contraception to the states. In May, Maine enacted legislation allowing pharmacists to provide emergency contraceptive without a prescription, bringing to 6 the number of states that grant pharmacists this authority. As of last month, similar measures were pending in 4 additional states. Thanks to Heather Boonstra from the Guttmacher Institute for compiling this report. Last month, the New York City Department of Health announced an 11% decline in the number of smokers in New York City between the years 2002 and 2003. The decline came after a decade of limited progress in tobacco control in New York City and nationally, and constitutes the fastest drop in smoking rates ever recorded nationally. Data collected by the survey unit at Baruch College on tobacco use show that the proportion of New Yorkers who smoke dropped to 19% in 2003. That represents 100,000 fewer New Yorkers smoking compared with the previous year. Smoking rates declined among all age groups, all racial and ethnic groups, all boroughs, and among both men and women. The proportion of young adults age 18 to 24 who smoke decreased by 22%. Health Commissioner Tom Frieden called the report extraordinarily good news for the health of New Yorkers. Among 100,000 smokers who quit, at least 30,000 premature deaths will be prevented. He credited New York City's comprehensive smoking reduction program, which includes a large increase in the tax on cigarettes, implementation of the Smoke-Free Air Act, the nicotine patch distribution program, and public education about the health risks associated with tobacco use. According to Dr. Frieden, fewer New Yorkers are smoking today than at any point in the last 50 years. Most smokers want to quit, and for the first time ever, there are more former smokers than there are current smokers in New York City. Mississippi recently approved the deepest cut in Medicaid eligibility for senior citizens and the disabled that has ever been approved anywhere in the United States. The legislation ends Medicaid eligibility for 65,000 low-income senior citizens and people with severe disabilities who also qualify for Medicare. In signing the law, Governor Haley Barbour said that Mississippi taxpayers should not have to pay for free health care for people who can work and take care of themselves and just choose not to. According to some observers, the beneficiaries who will lose coverage under the law have diseases such as cerebral palsy and Alzheimer's, and income so low they effectively have no money to pay for health care. Coming up next, mercury pollution, and a look at both personal actions and public policies that can help reduce our exposure to mercury. So stay tuned. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. Mercury is one of the most toxic elements to which people are commonly exposed. It's used in many medical, dental, and industrial products. Unfortunately, it's quite toxic to the human nervous system. During the final years of the Clinton administration, the Environmental Protection Agency, known as the EPA, developed a policy which would have markedly diminished exposures to mercury in the United States over the next few years. Early this year, the Bush EPA decided to scrap the previous proposal. Instead, they developed a proposal which delays the mercury phase-out by several years. Public comments on this proposal will be accepted by the EPA through June 29th. The EPA's website is epa.gov. To provide us with some background on this proposal, I've invited Michael Bender to join us. Michael Bender is co-founder of the Mercury Policy Project and has directed the project since 1998. Mr. Bender has over a decade of experience working on mercury policy issues and over 15 years' experience in the municipal hazardous waste management field. In 2001, he helped form the Ban Mercury Work Group, a coalition of 28 non-government organizations from around the world, and represented that group last year at the United Nations Environmental Programs meeting in Nairobi, Kenya. Michael Bender, welcome to Public Health Radio.
Thanks for having me.
I'd like to start out our discussion of mercury by maybe giving a brief description of why mercury is a problem. How is it harmful to humans?
The problem of most concern is methylmercury, and especially for the developing fetus and young children. Methylmercury inhibits the normal development of the nervous system, an effect that occurs even at very, very low levels. This developmental effects have been found in children exposed in utero, even though their mothers did not experience any symptoms of toxicity.
Is mercury also harmful to children and adults?
That's correct. It depends on the dose. But we'll start at even low levels, such as that may result from maternal fish consumption. The studies indicate that infants and children may experience subtle neurological deficits, such as IQ deficits, abnormal muscle tone, and decrements in motor function, attention, and visual spatial functioning.
Which sounds like it would affect balance as well as ultimate intellectual ability.
Yeah, and generally what the researchers talk about is learning delays of a month or more, depending on, you know, the exposure.
And you're implying that in adults, they would need a heavier exposure to achieve the same level of harm?
They may, except for it really depends on the individual. Some people eliminate mercury from their bodies more readily than others. So it really depends on the individual. But in general, yes.
And you already mentioned that there's special concerns for pregnant women.
Obviously. Right, that's where the primary focus is, although there have been an MD in San Francisco recently conducted a study of 123 patients, and it's written up in Environmental Health Perspectives, and She found a, you know, direct correlation between elevated mercury levels from primarily consumption of large predatory fish and many mercury symptoms that went away after her patients reduced their consumption of those mercury contaminated fish.
For those listeners who may remember their high school chemistry, most compounds are capable of breaking down, but elements aren't because they're pure and they're not combined with anything else. And mercury, of course, is an element on the periodic table. So I have to assume that mercury is not going to break down once it gets in the body, and I assume then that the only way you can get this out of your body is if your body decides to excrete it one way or another through stool or urine.
That's accurate, or hair. Yeah.
Okay, so I'd like to ask you, once mercury gets into the human body, how does the body handle it and attempt to get rid of it?
Generally, it can be excreted from the body or urinated out, or like I said, it's taken out in the hair. Mercury has a half-life, and I believe it's 90 days.
In the human body.
In the human body. And so that's one of the main concerns for women who may become pregnant, is that they may have mercury in their bodies even before they're pregnant, that they may not know could harm a developing fetus even before they were pregnant, which is one of the reasons why it's very difficult to warn pregnant women, considering that, you know, half of all pregnancies are unplanned.
So far, we've talked about the effects, the toxicity of mercury to humans, and then how well the body does in getting rid of it. So I guess the last part of this concept would be why it gets into humans. How are humans generally exposed to mercury? Is it through air or water or food or through skin? How do we actually get mercury into our bodies?
The exposure route of most concern for the general population is through consumption of mercury-contaminated fish.
And I assume that some fish are more the culprit than other fish.
Yeah, the larger predatory fish have a buildup of more mercury. And
I assume that would be because they're eating larger numbers of smaller fish and they're not getting rid of it. Is that what's going on?
Yeah, that's exactly it. The larger fish are eating the smaller fish, and it's bioaccumulating as it builds up.
All right, well, maybe serving as an advocate for fish and indirectly for humans, why are fish exposed? Do they go out of their way to eat mercury? Like, what is their exposure?
The mercury gets methylated in the sediment, and it gets taken up in the fish, and the larger fish are eating the smaller fish, and the mercury builds up.
My understanding was that environmental exposure to mercury is not natural primarily, that there's some way that humans are using mercury and getting it. In other words, do you know what happened to mercury before there was, like, before the year 1000? Like, mercury obviously existed on Earth.
Yeah, I mean, one-third of the mercury in our environment is coming from natural sources like volcanoes. So
okay.
Mercury's been around for a long time.
Implying that two-thirds is getting there through industry or other human activity.
Through anthropogenic uses and releases, correct.
Okay.
And that's really the significant problem, is that buildup and just resulting in the last, you know, 150 years. They've tracked ice core samples, and they found the USGS has found a 20-fold increase in the last 270 years.
It would seem that clearly there's a huge human impact on this.
Yeah, absolutely. That's really the primary issue here is not the natural background level. It's what we keep adding. And the problem with mercury is that, like you said, it doesn't go away. What it does is it builds up in the global pool, and it stays in the global pool. So we have new emission sources, we have natural emissions, and then we also have this global pool that keeps building up in the environment, and it takes a long time for, even if we were to get back down to background levels, for the mercury to dissipate in the environment.
And what are the new emission sources?
Well, the primary sources are the coal-fired power plant emissions, as well as the chloralkali mercury cell technology, and for much of the developing world, the use of mercury in artisanal gold mining, as well as waste disposal of mercury-containing products in other industrial releases.
Like how we dispose of batteries and thermometers and things like that?
That's accurate. That's part of it.
And so you're also saying that mercury is incinerated at power plants to some extent, or industrial plants?
Mercury is incinerated in medical waste combustors, as well as in solid waste combustors. The levels have been going down in the U.S., as a result of new pollution control requirements on those facilities. Actually, that has resulted in a number of hospitals getting out of hazardous waste combustion units. So, you know, while we're seeing our consumer use of products and industrial use of products ending up in the waste stream and being either incinerated or landfilled in resulting in releases to the atmosphere of that mercury from those products and processes. And that's what the EPA study report to Congress found in 1997, that there was a plausible link between these emission sources and the mercury building up in the environment and getting into our food supplies.
So in other words, once it's in the air, eventually, mercury's heavy, and eventually it's going to settle or come down as rain, I assume,
absolutely,
and end up in the river.
Or dry deposition. You know, the mercury goes into the air, and it either rains down or through dry deposition on the land or into the water. And the big problem with mercury is that it doesn't go away.
So what actions do you feel should be taken to prevent mercury from getting into the environment? Because I assume we have to stem this tide from the first step, which is how it's getting released, and
right. Well, the first
I assume
thing,
cleaning it up, it would be much more difficult.
Yeah, the best thing to do is to just phase out all mercury uses wherever possible, and we've been able to see that happening in the healthcare community, where practically every device, a medical device or thermometer, there is a non-mercury alternative. We've also seen that in the industry, where practically every single use of mercury can be replaced with a non-mercury alternative. And then for the large source of mercury, which is the coal-fired power plants, we know there's technology out there that can reduce, that can capture more than 90% of the mercury that's currently being emitted from those power plants, which are the largest source of mercury releases in the United States.
So the question would taking those actions be more expensive for all of those industries than continuing to do it the old way? And I guess the other part of that question is, if that's the case, they have machines there that are using mercury, it's obviously going to cost them money to replace them. Is there an important role for state and federal government to require that or find some way to get industry to change their processes?
Oh, absolutely. What we're seeing is, you know, the industry sees the writing on the wall, and wherever possible, you know, the industry is reducing or eliminating its use and release, and we've seen that across the board. We've seen dramatic reductions over the last 10 or 15 years. What we're left with, however, are the the coal-fired power plants and the dental offices and a few other renegade mercury sources that persist in being allowed to release mercury haphazardly into the environment, and clearly those sources need to be regulated. They haven't done it voluntarily up till now, and it's clear the only way to get them to clean up their acts is to require them to do that. And a number of states are doing that. Connecticut passed a law last year, and Massachusetts just adopted regulations this year that will require coal-fired power plants to reduce their emissions significantly over the next several years. In the case of dental offices, the same thing. We're seeing laws passed in a number of New England states and spreading across the country that will require dentists to capture the amalgam through separators and to keep that material from going into the waste stream and into our environment.
But it would seem to me that this would not be an interstate issue, that this would affect one state's actions, like Vermont, might affect Connecticut because the Connecticut River flows toward Connecticut from our area up here in Vermont. So I have to assume that there would be a role for the federal government in terms of regulating mercury.
Well, there absolutely is, and the unfortunate situation we're in right now is that the present administration is not following through on the commitment of the prior administrations to regulate the outstanding power plant sources of mercury as well as some other important sources, and they're also not following through on international opportunities to work on solving this problem globally.
Well, why don't you take those one at a time? What has happened within this country?
The Bush administration formally proposed a plan at the beginning of this year with a goal of reducing mercury emissions by about 15 tons by 2018, as well as allowing pollution trading. This change in direction will result in three times as much mercury pollution for decades into the air, and will also allow for this cap and trade program that will leave many communities still being right in the direct line of fire of mercury releases from coal-fired power plants. So
you're saying that the trading part of this is not helpful, but what the first thing you said was that they're trying to reduce mercury emissions by 15 tons. Was that it?
By 2018, but
so that sounds good.
Well, it sounds good if you weren't aware that what the industry and what the previous administration had already agreed to through a lawsuit settlement was to have much more stringent regulations that would reduce mercury emissions much quicker and at much greater rates than what the Bush administration is proposing. So we're basically seeing these coal-fired power plants getting a free ride for an additional 10 years at least on reducing their mercury emissions.
And you also mentioned that there are international agreements working to reduce mercury across the globe.
That's right. The United Nations Governing Council looked at the mercury problem in the beginning of the decade and instructed their staff to go out and conduct the first ever global mercury assessment report. The findings of that report indicated that mercury had global adverse effects that warranted aggressive international actions to reduce mercury levels, since it's recognized that fish, which is one of the world's most important protein sources, is being threatened by this increase in mercury contamination in the environment and the surface oceans. So after they came out with their findings in 2002, the Governing Council reviewed those findings in 2003 and recommended that government submit recommendations for international actions to address the global mercury crisis. And they would have done more except for the Bush administration blocked any discussions about an international treaty in 2003. The compromise was that they would be bringing it up in their next meeting in Nairobi in 2005.
So the U.S. has essentially brought about a two-year delay in dealing with the issue of mercury in international terms.
They've created at least a two-year delay, and by their lack of of leadership nationally for promoting technologies to capture mercury emissions from coal-fired power plants, they've set back the possibility of that technology transfer to other places as well. So it's really a twofold detrimental impact on solving global mercury pollution.
And now that we've talked about the social or governmental level actions, are there things that individuals can do today and tomorrow, say when they're shopping, certain types of fish that are particularly risky, like to reduce their potential exposures for themselves and their families?
Absolutely. You know, if they are women of childbearing age, women who might become pregnant, or parents of young children, they should avoid FDA's list of do not eat fish, which includes swordfish, shark, king mackerel, and tilefish. They should also consider, if they're in those sensitive populations, avoiding fresh tuna and the albacore white canned tuna, which has three times as much mercury as the light canned tuna. In addition to the federal health advisory, 45 states and territories now have fish consumption advisories warning women of childbearing age to avoid eating certain fish and to limit consumption of others.
So there seems to be a fairly broad consensus on
there is a broad consensus both nationally and internationally, and the states have really taken the matters into their own hand because of the federal government's lack of due diligence, and now we're seeing the federal government start to wake up.
Can you specify one or two websites that would be of particular interest?
Sure. We can start out with the Mercury Policy Project website, which is mercurypolicy.org, and then you can go to the Natural Resources Defense Council website, which is nrdc.org.
Well, Michael Bender, I'd like to really thank you for joining us on Public Health Radio.
Well, it was my pleasure. I appreciate you having me.
For listeners interested in learning more about the most recent recommendation about which fish are safe to eat, one can look at the website of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, fda.gov. As Michael Bender mentioned, the Bush administration has put forth a proposal that will significantly slow down the effort to eliminate mercury pollution. The Environmental Protection Agency has set a deadline of June 29th for public comment on the proposal. You can submit your comment via the National Resource Defense Council website, nrdc.org, or go directly to the EPA's website, epa.gov, that's epa.gov. Coming up next, we'll turn to another environmental problem that impacts the public health: organic compounds such as PCBs, DDT, and the potent cancer-causing dioxins. A global treaty has been developed to eliminate these compounds, and Karen Perry is joining us to discuss the treaty and how that treaty is likely to be implemented in the United States. So stay tuned. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. In April of 2001, on Public Health Radio's second airing, we discussed a class of toxic compounds commonly called persistent organic pollutants. These compounds represent a class of pesticides and industrial compounds with similar chemical features, which are cancer-causing agents and are also toxic to hormonal signaling in a great variety of animals. During the 1990s, representatives of many nations were engaged in a treaty negotiation known as the Stockholm Convention on Persistent Organic Pollutants. This treaty attempted to limit the production and distribution of these compounds. We asked listeners to write the Bush administration asking that the U.S. sign the treaty and submit it to the Senate for ratification. 1 month later, in May of 2001, representatives of the Bush administration did sign the treaty document, and it seemed that we were on the road toward a significant advance in the protection of public health. Unfortunately, developments since the signing of that treaty have not been so encouraging. To review the health risks associated with the persistent organic pollutants and to discuss developments related to the Stockholm Convention, Karen Perry is joining us. Karen is Deputy Director of the Environment and Health Program at Physicians for Social Responsibility, an organization of 30,000 medical practitioners active on issues of concern to public health. The organization was part of a coalition which was awarded the Nobel Prize for Peace in 1985 for their work opposing the proliferation of nuclear weapons. Karen Perry directs PSR's work on a number of environmental health issues. And for the 3 years prior to joining PSR, she served as coordinator of the International Network for the Elimination of Persistent Organic Pollutants. Karen Perry, welcome to Public Health Radio.
Thank you.
Can you just briefly describe what the persistent organic pollutants are and what their uses and also their toxicity would be?
Sure. The persistent organic pollutants are a class of chemicals. Most of them have been with us for a number of years. They include pesticides and also industrial chemicals that many folks may have heard of that include PCBs. These were used in electrical transformers and other kinds of electrical equipment. The persistent organic pollutants also include byproduct chemicals, so chemicals that are actually coming out of, for example, incinerator smokestacks or other kinds of industrial processes, plastic making and other kinds of things that come out of the industrial process by accident, but there they are going up into the air. So these are a whole class of chemicals that are related in the sense that they're all based on, they're organic, which means they're carbon-based, they're persistent, which means they last a long time in the environment.
A long time meaning?
A long time meaning years. For example, in the, I want to say back as early as the 40s and 50s, PCBs, these industrial, these electrical components were dumped by a precursor to General Electric in the Hudson River in New York, for example. Folks in New York will be familiar with the contamination because it's now the world's longest Superfund site. It's about 200 miles of the Hudson River that's polluted. Those PCBs have been there for decades. They stay in the sediments in the river bottoms, but they also do something known as bioaccumulation, which means that the smallest organisms in those river bottoms ingest the PCBs, take them into their bodies, and then the fish eat those and the larger fish eat those until you find that fish and wildlife and people at the top of those food chains are actually ingesting a lot of these chemicals. And so people have some of the highest, what we call body burdens, levels of these chemicals in their bodies, even though most of us don't know it.
Compared to rabbits or herbivores?
Exactly. And where we get them, again, is through food. So fish may be contaminated with various persistent organic pollutants. They end up in the milk of cows. They end up in meats and cheeses and eggs. And so it's part of our everyday diet that we have these pollutants going into our bodies unbeknownst to us.
So the implication of the fact that the organisms like humans that are higher on the food chain, the implication that they would have a greater body burden than organisms that, say, eat plants exclusively, that they must be not excreting it, not getting rid of it.
That's right, because just the way they stay in the environment for many, many years, they also stay in our bodies for many, many years. It's hard for our bodies to break these chemicals down, so they are stored primarily in fatty tissue. You'll find them in tissues like breast milk, which is high in fat.
You mentioned earlier that one of the sources of these persistent organic pollutants is incineration. And is it fair to say that currently most of the bulk of these pollutants that are being added to the environment are dioxins that are getting into the air from incineration of plastics? Is that fair to say?
Well, that's certainly one source, but there are a number of different industrial sources of dioxins and related chemicals. So incinerators are one, plastics manufacturers another, paper manufacturers, so pulp mills also release dioxins, a variety of different kinds of industries.
Now, earlier I interrupted you when you had already explained that these compounds are persistent in the environment and even in our bodies, unfortunately, and you explained what it meant that they're organic compounds, but I interrupted you, and maybe you were going to say what the nature of their harm is and how they are pollutants.
That's right. The last piece is that they are, in fact, toxic. And we know they're toxic from lots of different kinds of observations. People who have higher levels of these chemicals may have lower sperm counts. Men may have lower sperm counts. Women may have various reproductive problems, just problems that may make it harder to get pregnant. Dioxin that is in the body of a female mouse that's pregnant can have effects on the developing mouse fetus. For example, talking about PCBs again, there are really good studies in wildlife, but also in people that show, for example, Great Lakes fish are contaminated with PCBs, and there were studies that were done a number of years ago in Michigan that showed that children born to mothers who had eaten Great Lakes fish contaminated with mercury, and we're not talking about a lot of fish. We're not talking about people who eat fish three times a day every day, but just women who ate sort of ordinary to moderate levels or amounts of fish while they were pregnant and even before they were pregnant, that their children actually score lower on neurological tests, tests of learning and memory and other brain function than do their peers whose mothers perhaps didn't eat those PCBs in the fish when they were pregnant. So these chemicals can have a wide variety of adverse health effects in animals, but also in people.
And the dioxins are one of the few chemicals that the EPA has designated as cancer-causing. Is that not right?
Yes, there are many kinds of dioxins, depending on their particular chemical structure, but the one that is believed to be the most toxic has, in fact, been called by EPA a known human carcinogen. So we do know that it's implicated in various cancers, including lung cancer.
You mentioned that persistent organic pollutants cross the placenta and would be expected to affect the human fetus, and also that these compounds appear in breast milk. So this would clearly raise the issue of how we can minimize our children's exposure.
I mentioned that breast milk is contaminated. It's really important for people to understand that even though breast milk might have these contaminants, almost all doctors agree that breastfeeding is best for mother and baby. So even though there are contaminants, the benefits of breast milk outweigh them.
And for the future, we should try to make it so that breast milk can become even safer.
Absolutely, because breast milk and because fish and because other foods that we're talking about that are contaminated are so important to us. Rather than tell people how much fish you can eat or have women worrying about whether they should breastfeed, really preventing contamination of these important foods is important, and that's why this treaty and our implementation here in the United States is so important.
3 years ago when we first addressed this topic on Public Health Radio, we were encouraging listeners at that time to try to contact the federal government, both the Bush administration and their legislators, to try to get the U.S. to sign on to an international treaty. And then a month later, in fact, the U.S. did that. And so at the time, I was under the impression that the problem was solved, at least in terms of getting international cooperation to begin to work on these chemicals. So I guess I'd like to ask you is tell the listeners about what the treaty was attempting to accomplish and what's occurred in the subsequent 3 years.
Well, that's right. This is really a groundbreaking treaty. I often refer to it as one of the world's first public health treaties in the sense that it actually would, because these chemicals are known to be very dangerous to people's health in the ways that we talked about, it would seek to eliminate these chemicals, this whole class of chemicals altogether in countries around the world. And the treaty was negotiated over a period of years, and in fact, as you mentioned, 3 years ago, it was signed by 90 or 100 countries. More countries signed it later, so in fact, it's been signed by 150-plus countries at this point. For your listeners who aren't familiar with treaty process, countries have to first sign a treaty saying they intend to abide by it, and then they do something called ratifying a treaty, which actually formalizes that intent to participate. And the United States has not yet ratified the treaty. That requires a vote, 2/3 vote of the U.S. Senate to do.
Did the treaty get voted down, or are they waiting till there's enough support? Do you know whether it's close to having enough support in the Senate?
Well, I think the issue is less support in the Senate than a related issue of legislation that needs to be passed to implement it. So there hasn't been a ratification vote in the Senate. I think that probably the Senate would support ratification of the treaty, and that's not an issue. The issue is that the Bush administration has proposed implementing legislation, and this is legislation that both the House and the Senate would need to pass, that essentially takes existing U.S. law and amends it in order that the EPA can carry out the duties of the United States under the treaty. So it just allows us to participate fully in the treaty. The legislation that the White House has proposed is unfortunately not fully consistent with the treaty. One of the things that the treaty does, I talked about persistent organic pollutants being a class of chemicals. The treaty spells out 12 of those chemicals, and the PCBs and the dioxins and DDT are among those 12. And they're the ones that are sort of the oldest, most well-known dangerous persistent organic pollutants. But the treaty doesn't stop there. The agreement also spells out a process in which other persistent organic pollutants would later be added, and that countries that are part of the treaty would then take action to eliminate those as well. Countries who are part of the treaty would nominate chemicals. So you might have another pesticide, for example, the pesticide lindane, which used to be used a lot in agriculture but now has only limited uses. And it's very similar to some of these other pesticides that we're talking about. It's one that might be added to the treaty in the future. Countries would nominate them, and then there's a committee that the treaty sets up that would screen them and look at all of the issues related to those chemicals. Are they in fact persistent? Do they bioaccumulate the way these other chemicals do? And are they toxic in similar ways? If a chemical that's nominated is deemed by this scientific committee to be a persistent organic pollutant, then the countries could agree to add it to the treaty. Well, over here in the United States, under the legislation proposed by the White House, even if all the countries in the world that are party to the treaty agree that lindane or some other chemical is in fact a persistent organic pollutant that should be acted upon, And even if the United States was part of all of those discussions and agreed, the legislation would not require the EPA to take any action here at home. So, in other words, there's one thing going on internationally, but it's not being followed up here in the United States under this proposed legislation. And we don't think that that is full implementation of this treaty. So that's one of the things that has really held up the ratification. It appears as though the White House has a view of this treaty that it's actually about 12 chemicals, when in fact the rest of the world views the treaty as being about a whole class of chemicals, starting with 12, but including others.
Is it important that the U.S. ratify the treaty, which seems not to be happening?
I think it's extremely important. As you know, the United States is a major player in many kinds of international agreements and efforts. And, you know, the world looks to the United States for its technical expertise, and we have sort of the top science when dealing with environmental health hazards like these chemicals. So the world is really looking to the United States to take an active role. And so I think it's very important that we ratify the treaty. And I think it's important that we have the capacity, that our EPA here in the U.S. has the capacity and the will to address and eliminate future chemicals along with the rest of the world. You know, we talked about PCBs and how harmful they can be and how much of the United States and the world is actually already contaminated with these chemicals that we really have a hard time getting rid of after the fact. I think what we're talking about when we think about chemicals that might be added to the treaty in the future is sort of averting those future PCB catastrophes. There are a number of chemicals, one in particular that is called a brominated flame retardant. This is a chemical that's added to sofa cushions. You might find them in the cushions of your office chairs. They are added to the hard plastic casing of your computer screen. They're there for a really good reason, to prevent everything in your home or your office from going up in flames if there is a fire. However, at the same time, they seem to have many of the properties that make PCBs so dangerous. They are persistent. They are bioaccumulating, so we're starting to see them in Sweden, in Texas, in many other places around the world, in people's bodies, in women's breast milk. While there's not as much research on the health effects of these chemicals as there is with PCBs, they seem to have similar effects in those studies that have been done. So I think it's really important that we take a long view of these chemicals and that we try to phase these chemicals out before they become a huge problem around the world and here at home. And the legislation that the White House has proposed for implementing this convention, this treaty, wouldn't do that.
The EPA is often criticized for not using the precautionary principle, which would require analysis of the safety of new chemicals before they're put on the market and allowed to be used. And in the area of persistent organic pollutants, I would assume that if new chemicals that are that a certain manufacturer wants to start using, that if they have a certain chemical structure, that there would be reason to be suspicious.
That's right.
You know, if they have chlorinated or brominated organic compounds, that would be a start. And I assume that scientific experts would easily be able to make conjectures about toxicity. And I guess I'm wondering, do you know how the treaty addresses not merely adding new compounds after they're proven to be toxic, but suspicious agents that might just be coming on the market?
That's right. Well, I'm glad you brought up the precautionary principle, and this is this is a principle of international law that says, and that has in fact been used in many different countries in their domestic practice. The precautionary principle says that when there is the threat of a serious harm, action should be taken even if all the information isn't there. So even if we don't know exactly how or why that harm might result from a particular activity, for example, the use of a new chemical, if we think that there's a good chance that there would be significant harm, then we ought not to use it. We should just not wait for all the information, because oftentimes when all the information comes in, it's too late. The chemical is already out there doing what it's doing. And the treaty that we're talking about, the Stockholm Convention on Persistent Organic Pollutants, actually incorporates the precautionary principle in it. It says, among other things, that when a country nominates a new chemical, that of course the country needs to provide lots of information about the chemical. The scientific committee that will look at the chemical is going to want to see all the information that's out there. But the treaty also says that incomplete information shouldn't stop a proposal from going through. It shouldn't stop the countries from looking at whether something is a persistent organic pollutant and, in fact, agreeing to take action on it. And this is something that the countries in governments in Europe actually do a lot of. Sweden, for example, and other countries in Europe routinely think in this kind of precautionary way and, in fact, are starting to change the way they regulate chemicals to correspond to the precautionary principle. So, in other words, we don't need to wait until we know every single bit of information about what a chemical does when it gets in the environment or how exactly it operates in our bodies that may cause damage. If we think it's going to be harmful, then we should use something that's safer.
What would you like to see interested listeners do who are concerned about this issue?
Well, I think one thing that people can do is actually write letters to their members of Congress and to their members of the Senate. Again, the Senate will have to vote to ratify this treaty, but both members of the House and Senate will need to pass legislation to implement it. So I think letters to members of Congress saying, we think that the Stockholm Convention on Persistent Organic Pollutants is really important. The United States should ratify it, but the EPA needs to have the power to implement all of the treaty, not just some of the treaty. Those would be wonderful letters. And if listeners want to easily send letters like that via email on the web, they can actually go to the website called www.envirohealthaction.org/action, and they'll find a letter there ready to be sent to your member of Congress.
Would you be able to direct interested listeners to websites where they can learn more about the issue?
Sure. If people really want to know details of the Stockholm Convention on Persistent Organic Pollutants, they can find that information at www.pops.int.
Karen Perry, I'd like to thank you for joining us on Public Health Radio.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for today's show. If you want to give us some feedback, or if you missed part of today's show and want to hear it, or want to tune into any of our previous shows, check out our website, publichealthradio.org. That's one word, publichealthradio.org. Thanks for listening, and join us again next month for another airing of Public Health Radio.